Imagine for a moment if you could bottle your most perfect moments of love. You know, those absolute firsts, a first confession, maybe that first real intimate connection, and just replay them whenever you wanted.
Sounds pretty amazing, doesn't it? Like a dream.
Exactly. Like preserving pure happiness forever.
Mm-hmm.
But what if that preservation came at a cost? A really profound cost, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Like the future, the growth, even the agency of the people you say you love.
Oof. Yeah, that changes things.
It really does. And that's the, well, fascinating and honestly pretty melancholic idea we're diving into today. We're looking at a concept for a fantasy romance story called Lotus Jewel Box.
Right.
And we've got some really detailed design documents. They outline the setting, characters, themes, even the magic system of this world. It's quite intricate.
So our mission today, for you listening, is to kind of pull out the most important bits of insight from these documents. We'll unpack the main idea, explore these unique ethical questions it raises, and sort of reveal how love, memory, and choice get tangled up in some really surprising, maybe even chilling ways.
Okay, so when you first encountered this idea, bottling a first love, what jumped out at you? Was it the temptation or maybe the immediate like ethical red flag?
Well, both really, but I think the temptation is key, especially for the main character here. At the heart of Lotus Jewel Box is Clavis Checkup. He's the village alchemist.
Okay.
And he's described in the notes as kindness turned recursive, which is such an interesting phrase. It means his desire to be kind, or maybe his desire to avoid causing any pain or loss, actually loops back and creates this deeper, more subtle kind of harm.
Huh. Recursive kindness.
Yeah. And it stems from his core wound, a terror of what the documents call subtractive choice.
Subtractive choice. What does that mean for him? Like choosing one thing means losing another.
Exactly that. He was terrified of hurting anyone by making a choice, specifically choosing between three women he loved. He couldn't bear to subtract two of them from his life or perhaps from happiness as he saw it.
So instead of
choosing, he froze everything. He had these perfect first confession and first intimacy moments with each of them. And then he used this forbidden magic, a lotus elixir, to bottle those specific moments.
Wow. And that just erased their memories.
Their conscious memory of those specific moments, yes. It allowed him to replay what he saw as like distilled affection, perfect moments on repeat. It really shows how trying to avoid hard choices, even if you think you're being merciful, can actually cause this deeper ongoing harm.
So he literally created what the sources call a stasis machine for love.
Mm-hmm.
It's chilling.
It is. And it apparently started with this idea of mercy. He thought, I owe each of them separately, right? But that intention, it curdled into a stasis machine.
Yeah, that word curdled is powerful. It brings up this core question this story seems to be asking. Is love preserved, actually love denied? Can it even be love if it can't grow or change?
Precisely. And, you know, what happens to him? What kind of person does Clavis become when he's maybe forced to finally face this, to unstopper the past? And the magic system enables this. It's described as low fireworks, high residue. So not flashy explosions, but subtle manipulation. Memory itself behaves like a volatile reagent, like a chemical.
So he can literally handle memories like ingredients.
Sort of. He's readministering this thrice distilled pure love extract to them in microdoses, basically letting them relive that first night over and over without the context or growth that would normally follow. It's incredibly delicate, but also incredibly dangerous.
And this feeling, the spaces, it's not just in his head, right? The setting reflects it too.
Absolutely. Wintner's Hollow, the village itself is described as being in this kind of perpetual late winter, early spring mood.
Ah, like everything's always just about to thaw, but never quite does. Mud and melt.
Exactly. Thaw, mud, lingering snow melt. And the town itself is small, intimate streets, a modest economy. It reinforces that stagnation because it's like not rich enough to hide its problems, but not poor enough to be forced into changing anything drastic.
So it's perfect for emotional drift,
yeah,
as the notes say.
Yeah. Just
okay, so in this perfectly stuck village, Clavis isn't alone in his drift. He's got these three women he's obsessed with. And you said each had a defining virtue in that first moment that he bottled.
That's right. And removing that virtue, that spark, leaves them functional, maybe, but like shells. They're missing that catalyst, that thing that would have pushed their evolution, their growth.
Which ties into this theme of virtue extraction.
Exactly. Each bottled first took away a virtue vector, that's the term used, it literally changed their developmental path. And this is part of what the documents call distributed betrayal.
Distributed betrayal. So not one big dramatic act, but lots of small ones.
Precisely. 1,000 small, kind interferences, the notes say. Things that seem minor, maybe even caring on the surface, but they add up to this structural theft of agency. It's really insidious.
It really is. Control disguises kindness. Okay, let's meet them. Who's the first heroine?
First is Lena Arvel. Her bottled virtue is vintage courage.
Vintage courage, okay.
She's an aspiring swordswoman. And her confession to Clavis, that initial moment, was apparently the absolute pinnacle of earned bravery for her.
But without it.
Without it, she defaults to safe acceptance, just going along with things, which leads her to get engaged to the local blacksmith, a guy named Tolan. Probably not the path she would have taken with her courage intact.
That's heartbreaking. Does she still interact with Clavis?
Yeah, she visits him for muscle salves, you know, for her training. And he makes them mint honey flavored because she apparently grimaced at the bitter ones once.
Oh, man.
So she gets cared for, but as the notes say, not as a warrior, but as a girl. And she even says to him, "You still keep the blend just how I like it, even after all this time." You hear the echo of what's missing.
Yeah, that little detail, the salve flavor, it speaks volumes about the lost connection, the lost courage. Okay, who's next?
Next is Maeve Grancel. Her virtue is private sincerity.
Private sincerity, interesting.
Yeah, she's a merchant's daughter. Publicly, she puts on this mask, bratty flirt, mercantile opportunist, very calculated. But her bottled first with Clavis contained this moment of raw, frightened honesty that she apparently hates showing to anyone. So losing it reinforces her public mask.
So she visits him too.
She does. Ostensibly to buy supplies in bulk, haggle flirtatiously, play her usual game. But her real motive, hinted at, is to try and figure out his formulas, crack his recipes.
Why?
To prove she could be trusted with them, maybe? To show him she's more than the mask. She even asks him, "You could teach me that recipe already." Or is it a family secret, Doc, with that flirty tone?
So she's probing, testing him.
Exactly. She's described as the detective of the group. She's noticing things, unaccounted time blocks, scent residues, unexplained love marks. The documents say she suspects something before anyone else. She's actively trying to figure out what's wrong.
Okay, Maeve the detective. And the third woman?
Sanli of Koryosha. Her virtue is sealed connection.
Sealed connection. And she's an absolver. What's that?
Sort of a spiritual guide, it seems. Her public persona is serene, distant, ritual exact, very controlled.
And her core need?
Is for continuity of being held and witnessed without erasure. She wants to be truly seen, remembered, whole. Which is deeply ironic, given what Clivus does.
Terribly ironic. How does his magic affect her specifically?
Well, she carries something called a thrice trace brand related to her absolver role. And because of the residual mnemonic harmonics, the echoes of the bottled memory and their, well, physical compatibility.
Compatibility.
Yeah, the brand actually flares up when she's near Clavis. It's like a physical reaction to his interference and their underlying connection.
Wow. So she visits him for...
tonics. Specialized ones to suppress these flare-ups. She holds the bottle, and the notes say she's weighing something heavier than medicine.
You can feel the tension there.
Definitely. She says to him, "This keeps the echoes quiet, but not gone." You know that, don't you? There's this undercurrent of awareness, of shared secrets, almost.
And adding another layer, her role is to guide people to ideal matches.
And guess who registers as a perfect match for her, according to her absolver senses?
Oh no, Clavis.
Yep. Even though she hates how easily her body, or maybe her spirit, seems to agree with that assessment, despite everything, wow. It's a really tragic conflict for her.
Wow. Okay, so the setup is intricate. How does this translate into, like, gameplay? The notes mention a Harvest Moon gameplay inversion.
Right. So Harvest Moon, for those who don't know, is often about farming, community, building relationships, eventually leading to marriage, right? Progress.
Yeah, commitment is the goal.
Here, it's flipped. The player, presumably is Clavis, is encouraged to reenact Red Heart pre-marriage states infinitely. You keep replaying those peak first love moments, but progress is deliberately halted.
So you're stuck in the honeymoon phase forever, but it's artificial.
Exactly. And it draws inspiration, interestingly, from what the sources call AI Chatterpie loop culture. You know, that idea of endless first-time simulation.
Okay. I see the connection.
That concept is made into an actual in-universe mechanic here. And the point seems to be to make the player complicit in gentle harm before realizing full weight.
So you start off thinking it's maybe okay, just replaying nice moments.
And then you start to feel the cost. It's designed to elicit mourning for milestones that technically happen but no longer live in the heroine. You feel the absence, the stolen growth.
That's powerful. And the player's choices influence this. You mentioned hidden axes.
Yeah, two key ones. Attachment to bottles and sense of duty. They're tracked subtly.
How do they work?
Attachment is about how much you, the player, invest in the bottles themselves. Do you replay them a lot, polish them, rename them, combine extracts, really lean into Clavis's method? Or are you willing to pour them out to let go?
Okay, so investment in the stasis.
Yeah.
And duty.
Duty is about your actions towards the heroine's actual lives. Do you intervene to help them grow? Do you refuse to use the bottles exploitatively? Do you try to make amends, like public penance? Or are you avoidant, indulgent, passive?
And you wouldn't see, like, plus one duty on screen.
No, no. It's subtle. The example given is the color temperature of the workshop lamp might shift slightly. Little UI hints that communicate your moral drift without breaking immersion. You just feel the atmosphere change based on your choices.
I like that. So your choices, tracked by these axes, impact things like loop count, how often you replay memory.
Right. And the stagnation index, how much their real lives stall.
And virtue integrity.
Yeah.
How much of that original spark remains in the bottle, or maybe even in them somehow.
Exactly. All these factors build up.
And eventually lead to.
A critical juncture. A point where the game takes a snapshot of your attachment and duty scores, and that determines the ending. This really highlights the theme of relational entropy.
Relational entropy, meaning?
Meaning that relationships, like anything else, tend towards decay or dissolution if there's no active energy, no authentic growth put into them. Parallel lives drift apart. They find other anchors if the original one isn't real or present. Bottled love just can't keep up with time.
Okay, so let's talk outcomes. What are some of the endings based on these quadrants of attachment and duty?
All right, let's look at Leonette. Vintage courage. If you have low attachment, meaning you're not clinging to the bottles, and high duty, you've tried to act responsibly, you might get the unstoppered vows ending.
Unstoppered vows. Sounds hopeful.
It is. Clavis actually uncorks her vial, and significantly, he pours the other two into the soil, a real letting go.
Does she remember everything?
Not fully consciously, but she gets somatic echoes, like a physical memory, a gut feeling. And she recovers one line from that first confession, I wanted to try again tomorrow.
Wow.
And then she initiates a new confession, completely unprompted by magic. She chooses growth, breaks off her engagement with Tolan honorably. It's about reclaiming her courage.
That's a powerful resolution. What about Maeve, private sincerity?
Okay, let's say you have low attachment again, but also low duty. Maybe you weren't invested in the bottles, but you were also passive about helping.
Huh?
This could lead to the broken seal ending.
Broken seal sounds like confrontation.
Very much so. Maeve takes charge. She confronts Clavis, maybe even presents him with her ledger audit. Proof of the time gaps, the bruise maps she's been tracking.
Her detective work pays off.
Big time. She might even smash the other two bottles herself. And then she downs her own vial to reclaim her memories.
Whoa. What happens then?
It leads to what's described as a codependent but alive marriage. Still messy, but real. And there's this fascinating note about a power flip pillow scene where she becomes his chiding keeper. The dynamic is completely reversed. She's in control now.
Fascinating. Okay, what about Sanley? Seal connection, high attachment, high duty.
Right, so here you're invested in the memories, but also feel a strong duty towards them, perhaps. This leads to gaslighting.
Glasslighting, not gaslighting.
No, gaslighting. It seems they become custodians together. They engage in a co-curation rite, arranging these memory globules. It's like they accept the past, the bottles, but try to manage them ethically, consensually.
So a shared stasis.
A consensual chosen stasis together, yeah. Love isn't spoken much, but it's enacted through shared tending of an unspeakable menagerie of these bottled moments. It's very melancholic, but perhaps stable in its own way.
A very different kind of relationship.
Yeah.
But what if you go full bad end? High attachment, low duty.
Yeah.
Clinging to the bottles, neglecting the women.
Ah, that's a chilling one. The stasis route called white glass reverie.
White glass reverie. Sounds empty.
It feels that way. Clavis might go further down the forbidden path, mixing micro drops from all the bottles into some forbidden lotus reduction.
Oh, dear.
The heroine's visits become absent. They're just memory phantasms appearing to him. And crucially, Cladus himself becomes an echo as control is removed from the player.
So you, the player, lose agency too.
Exactly. It mirrors the agency stolen from the women. Their actual futures just proceed off screen, completely separate from him. It's the ultimate isolation, the ultimate consequence of refusing to let go or take responsibility.
That's heavy. And then there are these residue endings, like variations.
Yeah, these seem like outcomes if maybe the main relationship doesn't fully resolve or if things sour later. Like, Leonette might end up married to Tolin, but have visitations. Secret meetings with Clavis.
Still clinging to something.
Or Maeve might leave town, things don't work out, and she comes back. Resuming visits, but purely transactional ones. Routine service. And Sam Lee might end up having just scheduled care, clinical appointments, no personal connection left, just managing the flare-ups. These really hammer home that relational entropy idea. Life finds a way, but it might be a hollowed out version if the core connection is broken or artificial.
It shows that even if you try to freeze love, life.
Yeah.
Life just keeps moving and the connection frays or changes into something else entirely, often something sadder.
You've nailed it. The whole story seems to be, as the notes put it, a love story about not choosing and the grace or rot that follows when you finally must.
What an incredibly rich concept.
Yeah.
Really intricate. We've unpacked so much here. This idea of love, control, memory, and what it really means to let someone, you know, actually grow and change. That phrase, first love, thrice distilled purity is poison, that's going to stick with me.
Mm-hmm. It really shows how something starting from, well, maybe a place of kindness, or at least fear of causing pain, Clavis wanting them all to be happy, avoiding that subtractive choice can curdle. Like you said, it becomes this structural theft of agency,
yeah,
preventing their evolution, leading to that relational entropy. It's a really powerful, if maybe uncomfortable, lesson about what happens when love preserved is love denied.
Absolutely. So for you listening, here's something to maybe chew on. If you actually had that power, the power to freeze a perfect moment of love, lock it down, and maybe prevent any future pain or potential loss that comes with growth and change, would you use it?
Yeah, would you?
And if you did, what part of love itself and what part of the person you love would you end up sacrificing in the process?
It's a deep question. Hopefully this exploration gave you plenty to think about. Until next time, keep diving deep into the knowledge that shapes our world.